It's the second quarter of season 8, everybody. Brace yourselves. Poetic peeps and gentle persons, in-betweeners and non-conformers, genders all and genders equal. Welcome to Each of the Storms, the poetry podcast. My name is Damien B. Donnelly. This is season 8, and today we're celebrating episode 6 already. The seasons are flying past, but thankfully we're a podcast and you get to tune in whenever you choose and on whatever platform you prefer, including Spotify, Apple, Google, Breaker, Podbean, Player FM, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Castbox, Podcast Addicts, and iTunes. Today we have a Portuguese poet who lives in London, bringing Chopin waltzes to our palms. An American poet bringing us sour trees and honey. An Irish poet who talks about houses that are forever homes in our hearts. And an English poet now based in Belgium while teaching in the Netherlands, talking about love, loss, and the hard drives we have to take to make it through this life that crisscrosses over, around and through each other. So for the next hour and 20 minutes, put the exterior weather storms aside in place of this poetic space. Make sure the tea is in the cup, the whiskey is in the glass and the cookies are on the plate. My name is Damien B. Donnelly. This is Eat the Storms and I hope you enjoy the show. To start us off today, I'm delighted to welcome a returning guest to Eat the Storms and also a contributor to the Storms Journal and the guest who will join me again at the end of today's show for Behind the Storms, our new series of chats exploring the origins of our love of poetry and everything that happened after. This guest's debut pamphlet, Those People, was the winner of the Poetry Business Competition judged by Billy Collins, published by Smit Doorstep in 2015, followed by another pamphlet, The Days That Followed Paris, then Selfie with Water Lilies, and just last year, Carcanet Press published his debut full collection, Hard Drive, which you're going to hear him read from today. He grew up in Cambridge in England, has lived in Paris, Amsterdam, currently is living in Brussels, and is a university teacher in Maastricht in the Netherlands. Here today to share poems from that debut full collection, Hard Drive, which feel like hymns of love laid down next to stages of grief. I am very honoured to welcome back to Eat the Storms, Paul Stevenson.
Angle poise. You'll be in the front room at your computer, surrounded by your family of angle-poised lamps. The novel will be making steady progress. I'll be in the kitchen, with my laptop and radio, editing some poem or other, devoting an hour to the question of a comma, semicolon, full stop. Voices will drift up to me from where you are. My drama will drift down the hallway to you. There'll be hot radiators and rugs, curtains drawn. We'll both be home, absorbed in our projects, each working our way through the bottle of red. I'll be alive, you'll be alive. It'll be like old times. Signature. In his sleep, except he isn't really sleeping, that's just what we like to tell ourselves. He looks as if he's grinning, as if he knows something new, has seen a sight to comfort him and offer reassurance, so he can close his eyes for good. Or else he's understood, once and for all, what us lot don't, that this here is one massive joke, some lame farce from the beginning. I wouldn't be surprised, because he had his own sense of humour, black, in the mishaps and embarrassment, saw the human comedy, relishing the doddering and stumbling of others, their sticky situations, how they keep on talking, words making it worse, digging a hole for themselves. I look at his mouth and he's not saying much, but keeping stumm, lips sealed, mum's the word. And I'm positive, 100%, that he won't tell me what's tickling him. Not this time. I edge up, lean in and steep over. Allow myself to touch his forehead, lay my palm flat on the long fringe, and with my thumb caress each fine brow, stroke them in the right direction. Feel the love, cold and wet from refrigeration. Grief. It's not what it used to be. Because it used to be gravel, flicked up by a spinning car tire that punctured your heart. It used to be a hungry gruffalo that flattened you when you went for a walk. We're talking weeks, deep in a grotto with underground lakes, nothing but the drumming of stalactite drips drilling into your head. Back then it was the garbo of all garbos. I want to be alone, forever. A grueling Greek tragedy in 3,000 acts. It used to be day 4, and gripped by sorrow, the desire to drown yourself ungraciously at Hampton Court Lock. Officialdom. This case file is not concerning. It is not about. It does not regard. This case file is not relating to or pertaining to the matter in hand. This case file is touching the death of. And like a forefinger on the lips, I am touched by its usage, how it seeks to soften what is so hard. Grief as two sides of the Atlantic Ocean. This side me, that side them. This side 10 o'clock, that side 5. This side work, that side retirement. This side students, that side antiques. This side mobile, that side cell. This side pub, that side bar. This side centigrade, that side Fahrenheit. This side window, that side aircon. This side post-mortem, that side autopsy, this side aeroplane, that side airplane, this side mash, that side grits, this side stone, that side pounds, this side pan, that side skillet, this side shops, that side stores, this side license, that side license, this side pills, that side drugs, this side jug, that side pitcher, this side duvet, that side comforter, this side autumn, that side fall, this side harbours, that side harbours, this side getting on with it, that side too, this side telling everyone, that side no one. Clinically proven. I take your face creams. They're in the bathroom drawer, some empty, some on the go. Your Regenerist serum for neck and jawline from Olay. Your Regenerist 3-point superfirming serum from Olay. Your Regenerist microsculpting cream from Olay. Your Revitalift concentrated serum from L'Oreal Paris. Your Revitalift Miracle Blur oil-free instant skin smoother from L'Oreal Paris. Your Revitalift double lifting day jour moisturizer from L'Oreal Paris. Your Revitalift triple power day and night cream from L'Oreal Paris. Your Revitalift broad spectrum SPF 20 sunscreen from L'Oreal Paris. Your Men Expert Vitalift lifting moisturizer with intense double action Protensium and Pro Retinol 2-in-1 firming gel plus anti wrinkle cream from L'Oreal Paris. You should see my face. It's so smooth. The éclat the glow. Enter the gyre. They estimate that about 1.75 to 2.45 million tons of grief enter our system each year. Grief is twice the size of Texas and three times the size of France. As grief is discarded into the environment, its concentration continues to increase. Much of the grief is less dense than joy, meaning it will not sink beneath the appearance of happiness. The strongest, most buoyant grief shows resilience outdoors, allowing it to be transported over far distances. It persists at the surface as you make your way round, carried by currents and gathering, accumulating and forming the giant human patch of grief. One day, all the grief collected enters the gyre. It is unable to leave the area, degrades slowly into small pieces under everyday effects of waves and sun. St. Pancras. I want my time with you for a coffee in St. Pancras. I wanted my time with you over coffees in St. Pancras. I wasted my time with you during coffee in St. Pancras. I fasted my time with you sipping coffee in St. Pancras. Fast was my time with you, quick coffees in St. Pancras. Fate was my time with you, the last coffee in St. Pancras. Writing to your mother. Whenever I sit down to write to your mother, there's the question of you. And whenever you come into my head, there's the decision to be made whether or not to mention your name. Whenever I go to mention your name, it's another reminder you've gone. And whenever your goneness seems violent and I recall your mother will be reading my words, I search for something more upbeat. Whenever I start searching for what's upbeat, I end up mining for a funny episode, an anecdote, falling back on your silliness, and see your mother's eyes passing over my words, her mouth turning up at the edges. Whenever your mother's mouth turns up at the edges, she's using the many muscles it takes to smile, and in the process, that small smile may fool her into thinking she is living a moment of happiness. Wedding in Limousin. I'm writing this in the swimming pool. In a swimming pool in which I am the only swimmer. I've stopped swimming to write this poem, here alone, just arrived, my first swim. Three trains and a taxi, 38 degrees, a June heat wave. Standing here, cooling off, the robot cleaning underwater, almost company. A pen is letting out its ink. A notebook covered in wet patches from my wet arm, right hand. Blotched words. Sun hot on my back, the blanks of paper wrinkling into waves. France. Sound of a tractor and a moment ago, church bells. A breeze, honeysuckle. All this way. I've come to represent you, but I'm also here for me. Hey, a swallow just skimmed the pool, was off again. Sixth in a row. A swallow for each year you've been gone. It's time to swim.
For our next guest, we are taking flight and heading across the Atlantic Ocean to settle down in North Carolina in the United States for a new voice to Eat the Storms, whose work has appeared in places like the Kenyon Review, Magma, Bath Mag, and her debut collection, from which you're going to hear poems today, Dame Julie Andrews' Botched Vocal Cord Surgery and Other Poems, has just been published by Two Rivers Press, and just for the title alone, it deserves to have a place in your bookshelf. So sit back and settle down under the sourwood trees and honey, ghosts and grandparents and lots about losers. This is the co-organiser of Reading's Poets Cafe, currently researching tarot card ephrasis for a practice-based PhD. I'm delighted to welcome to Eat the Storms, Catherine Meehan.
Hi Damien. Thank you so much for the chance to read for Eat the Storms. I'm such a big fan of the podcast, so I'm really delighted to be able to share some of my work here. I'm going to read for you a couple of poems from my first collection, Dame Julie Andrews' Botched Vocal Cord Surgery and Other Poems. It was published with Two Rivers Press in 2023. The collection kind of came together in the shadow of some personal losses and failures, and I didn't really set out to write a collection about losers, but that theme started to emerge. So I decided I would kind of double down on it and really explore what it means to be a loser in all sorts of ways. The first poem I'm going to read is called Sourwood. This was first published in the online journal Anthropocene. Just a note on the title, the sourwood tree, it's a kind of shrub really, and it grows in the Appalachian Mountains near where I'm from in North Carolina. And there's a kind of honey you can get from the flowers, and it's not very sweet. This poem is for my dad, who died in 2020. Sourwood. It is embarrassing that I expected to see you. Though our cars are parked a quarter century apart, and each is fastened to its moment. The view from here, as far as I remember, was blue trees for miles. A trick of isoprene, of atmosphere, of light. Memory is story. Story is a choice. You were never one to make an effort. I don't know why I thought I could not cross paths exactly, but close some distances. Nope. Instead of you, I meet only what I had forgotten. How mica sheds its glitter down the paths. How it fractures. Tiny bits spangle the riverbed. The streams, the falls, I had forgotten these. Feral water, slow motion melt of gneiss. I want to tell you that I never lied, and I have realized this was not a kindness. I may have some learnings yet. The honeybee is at the sourwood, beside the white bells of its bloom, dancing to no music. The next poem I'm going to read is one of my favorites from the collection. This one was first published in Cranog magazine, and it is kind of it's based on a ghost story from my hometown. It's a version of the ghostly hitchhiker tale, where you pick up a girl on a prom night and try to give her a ride home, and when you get to the house, you turn around and there's no one in the car. It's very creepy. So this poem is called Pastoral Care. You were the prom dress with no body in it, thumbing the air at the county line near the banks of the wide Red River. No field was looking out for you. No shepherds stepped from the labyrinth of the corn. Not the monstrous American robin, its freakish stride upon the leaf mold, nor the cows. On the nights their calves are taken, they think only of themselves. No home for you. Roads only. Life is a golden pickup truck, you said, as golden as a hay bale heated up in the deep core, liable to combust. Oh, honey, you were the love song, hitched to the tree frog's chatter, consort of the unpaved trailer park, joy riding the fog beyond the chicken yard. You were the mist that sighs upon the windshield glass, the midnight voice crackling with lust. The cosmic pulse emits the radio static, when even the power lines had turned their backs. The next poem I'm going to read kind of belongs to the genre of poems about dead grandparents you've never met. And in my case, that's my paternal grandmother. And she is actually from the UK. She's from near Birmingham. And I live in the UK now in Reading. And the last place she lived before she moved to the US was Swansea. And through some weird trick of fate, I keep ending up in Swansea. So I was trying to write about her, and I couldn't really figure out how to do it because, yeah, I never met her. There was just a void. So I tried to think about what we might have in common, like, I don't know, a spirit of restlessness, perhaps. So this poem is called The Opposite of Ocean. The many blues the landscape owns, I want them all. I want cold melon soda. I want to be a bride, to drive cross-country with men, make a scrapbook. I want the Frito Misto at the Gower Seafood Hut. Attachment, I inhabit cattywampus, leaking brainwise, a dissociative transatlantic shock. I hold nothing, plonked, happily sinking in the estuarine sediment. Landsick, the beach sways from the knees up. Get me a windowless interior room, the sewage smell of ship's water. I want actual dolphins, white horses made of waves. I spend entire work days whistling into the storm. While I was working on the collection, I couldn't really spare the thought that loserishness necessarily entailed self-pity or somberness, or that I had to be serious about it. I started to feel like there must be moments to rejoice in being a loser, and I started to kind of chase those moments and write poems about them. So this is the final poem in the collection, and it is called The Pleasure Club. Stumbling towards the daytime party, the summer humid and loud in the pine wood, the quarry lake filled in with a reflection of trees, here is a cold beer bottle. Press it against your sunburned face. You have agreed to the spiritual practice of brunch. You have agreed to encase your thighs in cut off denim. You have taken erotic literature into your heart. You have taken a flat pack pleasure dome into the insensitive world. This is your lodestar. Visit every nude spa. Eat French fries with no underpants. Take a stand for games. You will climb mountains to the bar at the summit. If there is no bar, you will find a better mountain. You will poodle on your bike. You will leap and long. You will gallop like a feral dog. You will hold your lover's face between your hands like a giant hot dog. But first, here is the trail leading back to the party. You will trip over your feet until you reach a potluck dinner in a cottage with friends. The lamps are off except a year-round string of Christmas lights. There will be a balm in this house, the pursuit of survival. The world still exists for another day and another. Please believe, for once, you can be loved. The screen door's constant clap announces welcome. Thank you for listening.
We are coming back to Ireland now, welcoming another first-timer to Eat the Storms, this time the author of two poetry collections, both published by Salmon Poetry. The first in 2017, called After the Fall, and the second at the end of last year, called Hare's Breath, from which you're going to hear poems today. Poems which seemingly arrived when this writer was off supposedly doing a prose retreat. Never be prepared seems to be the lesson here for what may arrive. He is the author of the short fiction chapbook It's Not Me, It's You, the novel River Run, which was chosen as the winner of the Irish Writers' Centre Novel Fair in 2022. His poetry has appeared in places like Skylight 47, The Irish Times, Poetry Ireland Review, Abridged, and it's appeared on the poetry programme on RTE Radio 1 and the Poetry Jukebox installations in Limerick and Derry in 2023 as part of the Poetry as Commemoration. A member of the Hibernian Writers Group, I'm so delighted to hand you over to Brian Kirk.
Hi, my name is Brian Kirk, and I'm delighted to be taking part in Eat the Storms podcast today. Thanks very much to Damien Donnelly. I'll be reading from my second collection, Hair's Breath, and I'm going to start with the title poem. Now, a poem that I wrote last year while I was in Kilreelig, when I was supposed to be writing a novel, and I suppose it's about creativity, or the spark of creativity, and where it comes from. Hair's Breath. I came here to work, but needed to stop. That first day, tramping up Bola's head, mentally pulling together the threads of an unwritten story, trapped between ocean and mountain, eyes bent to the road, sheep droppings bunched like black grapes. I walked as words withered, eyes scanning the cliffs and those sheep, improbably balanced on a craggy incline. Hooded crows fought the wind. Then I saw her, shapeshifter, iambic, limber, crossing the hill. Frozen, lungs filled with wind, a hair's breadth, I held it a moment before it escaped. The second poem I'd like to read is called Belturbet Under Frost, and it's dedicated to my parents. A lot of the poems in the early part of the collection are to do with place and family and community. Belturbet Under Frost. For my parents, Terry and Anne. I marvel at the flawlessness of things, his shiny shoes, kind words, the cap he tossed in her direction, and the songs he sings that take him back. Belturbet under frost those winter mornings when he'd leave his digs, visit her shop before the Belfast train, the street in darkness still, to purchase fags, but really to see her. He can't refrain from idling in the warmth of her shy smile while the gruff owner indicates the time. Shouldn't you be on your way this while? He lingers by the door as the sun climbs over Kilconny Bridge and Rushing Erne. The stations pass. She waits for his return. The next poem I'd like to read is called Sundays in June. And it's about that adolescent time, I suppose, when Sundays seemed interminable. Sundays in June. When summer Sundays leaned into evening, the sky was clear, the light began to dim a little, and a tired silence occupied the best chairs in the house, leaving you uncomfortable, distracted. If only night would fall, if only day would end, you might stay home. The TV was no help, so you went out into the backyard where nature pretended to exist. The cars on the main road called out to you, sending you back to your room where you counted out the few remaining notes. The bus would be passing in half an hour. In the town, the amusement arcade would be hammering the senses. Pubs would be filling up, drinkers spilling out onto the sandy street, red faces soaking up pints, and the last rays of the sun as if nothing else mattered. The next poem I'd like to read is called The Last Days of Pompeii, and it's kind of a state of the nation poem that was written in something of a flurry, and it's addressing a lot of different things that were going on in the world at the time. It owes a bit, I think, in terms of how it's delivered to Kevin Higgins, the late Kevin Higgins, who was a great supporter of poets in general, and of me as well, which I much appreciate. The Last Days of Pompeii. You have the right to remain silent, but you should really speak. The barbarians are at the gate and plague is rife among the soldiery. Remember, anything you say may be used against you in a court of law, but who cares? There may not be a court anon. Titus will be dead within the year, a victim of his brother's ambition. You could go to Pompeii, kill some time in the brothels there, rely on Pliny's ships to save you when Vesuvius erupts. But Terra Mater will always find you, take you when you least expect it. You've ignored her for too long, shrugged off the views of sages, laughed at those who demonstrate their worries for the future of the empire. You have, of course, the right to have an attorney present before and during questioning, and if you can't afford that, to have one appointed without cost to you to represent you before and during questioning. By then it will be far too late. Domitian will be laying down the law, upsetting the elders in the Senate. Disease will bed in for the long winter ahead. You have the freedom to die quietly, infecting others as you go. And when you die, we'll bury you gratis in a convenient mass grave. Religion? Don't make me laugh. We are as flies to wanton boys, etc. They promised you the rising tide, and it will come like a tsunami across the Bay of Naples. The trickle-down has been delayed, but it can be procured at a price no one can afford. I'd like to finish with the poem called The Invisible House, and it's the final poem in the collection. It kind of ties up, I think, the whole future, past and present of the collection. And it's a poem that's very close to my heart. It's about the house I grew up in. The Invisible House. In dreams, I take the train from town, shunting through grass embankments to the station. Signal box, footbridge, goods wagon in the siding, the roof of station house visible behind hedges. I'm walking down the lane that never had a name, where a huge ash dwarfs the entrance to the backyard. Flat roof extension, the old timber shed built from creosote leaking sleepers, the garage we called it. A block outhouse with toilet attached, open steel tank on top filled with rainwater, sludge, dead leaves. And out in the field, the black shed, caving in, where we fattened pigs for market. A yard of gravel and muck with no path to the door. Open it. What do you see? Bare rooms where all stories began. Up the hall to the scullery and into the kitchen, flagged yellow and red, blackened by years and the comings and goings of feet, careless of time. Year after year we came and went as regular as the trains, the house filling up only to empty again over time, like rainwater in a barrel. Now it is a shell, a perfect multiplicity of difference, shaped around the body, snug and protective, warm and affecting the senses in ways that can't be explained. The kitchen hums an old song I can almost remember, cold as the pots that hang in the scullery, warm as the cold swallowing range. My voice strains to meet it, but can't reach the pitch of bubble and hiss, shallow dripping of rainwater, accumulating years of rust on the tongue. I'm standing at the top of the road, looking down on the car park, the ghosts of fields, lanes and sheds, the invisible house towering over the rows of shining and insipid cars. All day they wait, suspended, for something to happen, but nothing will. I walk around the lot, I don't care who's watching, and try the back door. It opens, as I knew it would, and I'm inside and everyone is here again. There's no more waiting now. There will be time for all of us to find the things we lost along the way, to learn the words of songs we longed to sing but never had the heart. And we will sound okay, better than we thought, and we will laugh at ourselves and only at ourselves, and laughing, share the joke with others. Thanks very much for listening.
My next guest recently read in an Instagram event hosted by 14 Poems, who published his debut pamphlet, Two Dying Lovers Holding a Cat. And I immediately sent him a message saying, please, 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 please come and be a guest on the podcast. And I'm delighted to say that he's here with us today and reading poems from that debut pamphlet, which so far I've now read three times and I intend to go back in for more. He is a queer poet and his work has been featured in places like Queerlings, Stone of Madness, Sage Cigarettes, and is upcoming in the anthology He, She, They, Us from Macmillan coming later this year. With a PhD from Goldsmiths and currently living in London with the ghost of a dead cat, I'm very excited to welcome to Eat the Storms, Luis Costa.
Hello, it is such an honor to be here today at Eat the Storms podcast, a true pleasure. I would like to say a huge thank you to Damien for inviting me, and also many thanks to all the listeners out there today. I will begin by reading a few poems from my debut pamphlet. It's called Two Dying Lovers Holding a Cat, and it was published by 14 Poems in November 2023. So here is the first poem. It's called, "Of Course He Smells Like Lemons." His face licked by the pink of neon lights, green marble eyes watching our warming beers in the dark. Under this table, shielded from the bright stars, his leg hair dances to Chopin waltzes in my palm. And I want to drink him so slowly, hard jawlines that softly simmer in the tender night. 400 days since I imagined air around his bed to melt in the sheets of meringue wrapping his thighs. Our day will come, he tells me. I did not kiss him for the last time just yet. The second poem I will be reading today is one that I don't think I've ever read as part of the events which I've done following the publication of the pamphlet. It's called Ornithomancy, which is the art of divination via the flights of birds. It was very common in ancient Rome. Ornithomancy. We are watching planes in the park, following currents, lost and found. Helens of Troy rescued before ants climb over our backs. Heat gathers. Men wipe forehead sweat with their boyfriend's t-shirts. Not you. I am a haunting, imagining the quiet trails towards your chest. I have borrowed this. Cloud jigsaws and the glistening dust. Machines ascend and descend to deliver promised embraces. As birds honor floating flares and burnt bites. Our lungs emerge, these emerald blades tame the hammerheads circling down, trickling as thick as sap inside the birch. Water which flows into the glass, a tongue in the lips, dreams that hold entire skies. Away from the daisies, my legs crushed, you will pretend we can contain the blue as our summer mouths swallow the flights. This book was written between London and Kraków, or Krakow in Poland. And it is a constellation of poems about love and about heartbreak, but also about endings and beginnings, meetings and departures. This poem I will read next is called Lipiec, or July, Lipiec being the Polish word for the month of July. I long to be a cherry in the lips of my lover, sinking deep in his blood, flowing into the ocean under the skin to crash my waves, exhaling onto the rocks where intrepid flowers grow. I also beg for the end of his sword to become desert wind blazing skies as summer turns forests into fire, embers, ash. I too long to be bitten as almonds from my homeland or to drip down his chin like dark figs. Above all, I want to be made of Californian grapes, ripening in the ginger warmth of his never-ending sun. A lot of the poems in the book occur in dyads, so they are paired. And it is the case for this one. They often reflect endings and beginnings, but not necessarily in a linear way sometimes. Lipiec, or July, has its counterpart, which is Listopad, or November. Listopad being obviously the Polish word for the month of November. This is Listopad, November. I am now a photograph, yellow as your corduroy disappearing down the road into the gust. For too long we feasted on birds swarmed by tides of weary lies that decorate the airport stairs. Your sleepy eyes were an estuary where my light was reflected to the city. I translated its colors, composed our lullabies. Between the mountains we became, sand turned to glass at last. How tall do cypresses grow here in the graveyard of our love? The last poem I will read today for you is a poem called Antigrade, and it's right in the beginning of the book, which also has a paired poem called Retrograde, but you should get the book to find out. I will be reading Antigrade now. Sundown leaks into the apartment. A passion fruit hue shrouds him slowly. He dreams of violins and gardenias. When I'm sad, I dream of plane crashes. Maybe I travel to the day Dolores left so I don't have to feel the rain on the night he will. Should I take a photograph or choose to remember? Maybe next November, when I open my birthday wine, 6 days too early. There'll be fireworks in his eyes and a purple glare from the off-license sign painting his face, now a map of a country that no longer exists. He would whisper, "We must break the leaves, light the bonfires. Maybe next November you will be striding." It only drizzles, but he is buying his new boyfriend non-celebratory wine. His mother died. Hands under the jumper, I hold him now, bearing music in new gardens. It would be easier if we could let this twilight burn, but there is a cat we will not adopt and that we never called Manhattan. Surely we are still young, and it's the night that's getting old. Thank you so much. I am Luis Costa, and it's been a real pleasure to read for you today.
And now that we've heard from all four of my guests on the podcast today, it's time to go back to the beginnings and get behind the storms with Paul Stevenson. Today, joining me for Behind the Storms is Paul Stevenson, whose debut pamphlet, Those People, was the winner of the Poetry Business Competition, judged by Billy Collins, published by Smith Doorstop in 2015. In 2016, he followed that up with The Days That Followed Paris, published by Happenstance, reflecting on the November 2015 Paris attacks. In 2017, he won the Paper Swan Press Poetry Pamphlet Prize for Selfie with Water Lilies. And last year, Carcanet Press published his debut collection, Hard Drive, an examination of death, grief, loss, of which Sean Hewitt wrote, "Stevenson looks death in the eyes and holds his nerve like few others." Born in Cambridge, England, he studied modern languages, linguistics and European studies, has lived in Paris, Amsterdam and Brussels, and even before his first pamphlet win, he had already taken second prize in the Troubadour International Poetry Prize and had been one of the Olber Eight poets. Later on, he went on to become one of the Poetry in Olber curators and is a university teacher in Maastricht in the Netherlands. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Damien, thank you so much for inviting me. It's fantastic to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure. And you're joining us from Brussels, yes?
I am. I'm working from home today. Yeah, I'm in Brussels. Rainy, cold, pretty grim out there.
So exactly like Dublin. We're sharing the weather today. So Paul, the Behind the Storms chats, they're all about beginnings. What attracted you to poetry in the first place? I know you have an MA in creative writing from Manchester Writing School, and you also took part in the Gerwood Avron Mentoring Scheme in 2013. But why poetry in the first place? Was there a moment that you remember first being captured by it?
I've always been into language play, and I was interested in linguistics. I studied French and German and Spanish, but never really did English literature. And I suppose my real passion was painting and art history for a long time. And then I think it was in my early 30s, I was working in France in an office in a sort of civil service style environment. And everybody was popping out for cigarette breaks. And I thought, gosh, this adds up to about an hour a day. How come they're allowed to go out for these extended breaks and I'm not a smoker and I can't? So I would just put a notepad under my arm, take a pen and go to the cafe across the road and just Yeah, just started scribbling, really. I had no poetry education. I just started writing short stories or little vignettes, nothing very good. And then went to Borders, or went to Galloway and Porter in Cambridge, and bought a few kind of old Faber titles, tried to sort of orient myself, bought a couple of magazines. But basically, poetry found me. I can't quite believe I could be living my life without poetry now. It seems impossible.
You might be the first person who's actually admitted that being a non-smoker is what started the poetry. That's
Probably, yeah.
incredible. Was it easy then, even though you have a background in linguistics, was it easy to get into poetry, to find your way into poetry without having actually studied it? Did you feel a sort of a bit more of a freedom?
It was a bit of a revelation, really, to sort of discover contemporary poetry and realize it's actually something quite different to what I thought, very accessible. And I suppose it suited me, you know, these kind of bite-sized pieces of text. It's almost like sculpture on the page, isn't it? Making a little machine. And I guess I moved to London in 2009, 2 or 3 years after sort of beginning to find my way in poetry. And that helped. You know, I'd go to the Troubadour, fortnightly reading series, go to some things at the Betsy Trotwood, try to go out and about and meet people, do a few writing classes maybe with the poetry school. I knew no one at the beginning, and it's just incredible how through poetry I have just have this incredible group of friends now.
And in terms of then submitting to the poetry business competition in the first place that you actually won, how much courage did it take? Did somebody encourage you to put together the pamphlet? Was it already
Well, I
there?
suppose I must acknowledge, of course, Peter and Anne Sampson, who you know, run the poetry business. I went to one of Peter's workshops, I think, when he ran one in Cambridge, and I ended up doing what was obviously a very important week. They had a week at Lumbank, the Arven property, and did a writing week. And I think that was very important for me in terms of, you know, them encouraging me to keep writing, to sort of slow down a little bit, but to keep writing, you know, introducing me to poets they publish in the North, poets like Tony Hoagland. You know, that was very important. Michael Lasky, of course, used to run Smith's Knoll. I used to send out to Smith's Knoll, and I think I did a couple of writing weekends with him. So there were some important people early on. And of course, Anne-Marie Fyfe, who ran the Troubadour, was very, very encouraging.
And had you always, you mentioned earlier that you were also writing short stories because so much of your poems, they are these little vignettes. There are these amazing, minute observations of moments, of people on the periphery, you know, of not necessarily close to you, but just these moments that you've captured. Has that always been something? Have you always been very aware of what's going on the borders around you?
Yeah, I think probably because I write often on trains or in cafes, or certainly in an urban environment where I'm very stimulated by, you know, what I see in signage, or what I overhear through announcements or through conversations at the next table. Yeah, and dialogue, which there's quite a bit of dialogue in some of my poems.
When those people, when the first pamphlet, when it actually came out, when you held it in your hands, was that the first time you considered you were a poet? Was that when the name or the title sort of latched on? Or had you already felt like you could claim that space of being a poet, that sense of entitlement?
That's a good question. I did the Gurwood Arven Mentoring Scheme and the Alba 8, both around the same time, 2013. And I mean, I was absolutely thrilled to be selected by Patience Agbabi to work with her as one of three poets. One of the others was Neil Campbell. And during that week, you know, we were told, encouraged to take ourselves seriously and call ourselves poets. And one of the things they did was, you know, trying to encourage us all to create our own website or start our own blog. And that act, I mean, you've done it yourself, of actually putting yourself out there and calling yourself a poet and putting yourself into the public space was, yeah, that was quite a leap forward, and not something that was necessarily easy. I mean, I think today we're more, yeah, au fait with everyone has a website and a blog and Twitter feed and Instagram. But back then it was really quite something, I think, to call yourself a poet, especially when I didn't have a publication. I had, yeah, lots of poems in magazines, but no pamphlet as yet. And yeah, as you say, those people came out in 2016. Yeah, to be chosen by Billy Collins, and then to go to the launch reading up in Grasmere, you know, for Peter to open the boot of the car and, you know, open this box, see all of these bright green pamphlets. It was really quite something. a very memorable moment.
Listen, we jump forward because I do want to talk about Hard Drive. So your most recent collection, your debut collection, which I said was published last year by Carcanet. It's not the first time that you've written about grief, about loss, but perhaps it's the first time where it becomes such a central character. With Selfie with Water Lilies, you confront the loss of your father, and certainly The Days That Followed Paris examines the loss, perhaps shared on a more global scale. But as with In Those People, you've interlaced all of those with these observations, as I said, about the everyday, the others, the absurdities, the communities, the overweight uncles, the school kids, the passwords, the brilliant poem that we'll talk maybe about later about beetroots. And of course, all this with this overwhelming skill of crafting every single line so perfectly. It's like watching a sculptor form your poems. You still retain all of this in Hard Drive. You still have these examinations, these incredible observations of those on the outskirts, the administrators, the funeral directors, the doctors, the taxi drivers. All these moments that perhaps allow yourself and even us as a reader to be able to distance ourselves at times from the grief that you say yourself in the poem is about two times the size of Texas. So it's a collection about the death of your long-term partner, Todd, at the age of 38. You said yourself that this wasn't the collection that you expected to write, but it turned out to be the collection that you had to write. Maybe you could tell us a little about those Hard Drives.
Yeah, I think, as you say, a lot of the things maybe that I'd been trying out in Those People and The Days That Followed Paris and Selfie, maybe I was channeling, trying stuff out, experimenting, playing around, and learning my craft, and then channeled that all into Hard Drive, where I had one particular subject I was always writing about. You know, with every prompt, he was there sitting on my shoulder, you know, and I was channeling grief.
What made you first write it?
I had two manuscripts on the go. I sent two manuscripts to Carcanet, actually. One was a manuscript of sort of the best of my work over, I think, 10, 12 years, called Auto Roots, actually. You know, six clusters of work on different themes. And then I had this other manuscript going on. And of many, many of the poems I'd been workshopping during COVID with my Saturday morning group. We went online in March 2020, and I was sort of in two minds, what should my first book be? What happens to all this work if I don't bring it together and I put the Todd poems out? So I sent the manuscript Hard Drive to Carcanet, maybe thinking I was all subconsciously self-sabotaging, actually, by saying, look, this is the other manuscript. If I know when you take poets onto a list, you want to consider, you know, do they have other future work? Mm. Here we go. And when we spoke 6 months later, they said that they felt that this was the manuscript that was original and the one that we had to foreground. And some of my poet friends had said it has to be these poems. And I thought, yeah, I mean, if I only get one book ever out there, you know, these are the poems I want published before I get hit by a bus, you know.
Yeah.
These are the ones that really matter.
How was it in planning? So it's broken down into six sections. Your first three are in chronological order after Todd's passing. Then you jump back and you give us this insight into the relationship, and then it zooms out again. Were they already in place when you approached, or?
There were five sections originally. The sixth section, which, as you say, zooms back out and looks at me as a writer from afar, kind of thing, and contemplates the whole act of writing grief and makes poems from that. That I sort of added as a sixth section. At one point, I thought maybe, you know, because this is getting big, this is a big book. And I think one of the reviewers has said it's too big. You're right. There were three parts that look at the performances and rituals and people engaged in these, in all of this that you have to do when dealing with the death. And then it goes back in time to explore the relationship. And I thought maybe that would be a sequel book, that I would have a book that goes back in time afterwards. A prequel, kind of a prequel sequel kind of thing. But I think friends said, you know, we need to know more. We want to know more about the relationship itself, you know, and that will give the poems earlier on when you reread them more meaning as well. So it was important to, because it is pretty hard going, a lot of the content, even though I try to come at it slant, or as you say, drawing on the absurdity of some of these situations and the very self-indulgent nature of grief. But I felt it was important to also celebrate the good times, you know, and look back.
And I heard you saying about it, you said that it was a dialogue with the dead. exploring the absurdity of life and death, the rather funny and often self-indulgent journey, I suppose, as grief always is. You know, it's always about the me now in this situation, as opposed to the person that we've actually lost. But I think what struck me most was that you said it was also a continuation of a relationship. And that struck me because I found it was so tender, so beautiful. But what struck me most was that I felt because you put this down, you laid your grief down in the book, but you interlaced it with memories of your relationship. Mm. It means that by putting that out there and giving it to us as readers, the relationship also continued on in us, because we then become the carriers of these memories that you shared with us. So it became almost a global continuation of
a relationship. That's a really interesting observation. Yeah, it's true. It's out there now. So that relationship is out there and belongs to everybody in a way. I mean, yeah, I think also because Todd was a writer, you know, he'd written short stories, he'd published quite a few academic articles, he was writing a novel. It felt also that, you know, a collaboration. We're writing this together. I'm drawing on, I'm not just inventorizing, but I'm drawing on everything, all the richness of what we had, and collecting it together, you know, for posterity. Yeah, I mean, I'm the author on the cover, but...
I suppose in that same question, there also comes the question of, was there a moment of questioning, did you want to share it? You know, was there ever a moment where you thought, maybe this is just mine, I don't want to let everybody in? Or...
Yeah, it's extremely personal, of course. And you have to, with the poems, distance them sufficiently so that you are retaining a little bit of privacy. Yeah. And obviously you embellish things, but everything is authentic and true in terms of the emotional heart of the poems. I mean, I think the poem at the end, Maybe Your Brain, that was a poem I was nervous about because I thought, am I taking too much of a risk? Is this too personal, what I'm doing here? Obviously, I had questions about, you know, legitimacy of what you're doing. Are you using somebody who's deceased? Very much aware that, you know, parents and friends would read this book. You don't want to upset anybody. But at the same time, as an artist, as a writer, you've got to take certain risks because, you know, do we need a book on death and loss and grief? So if you're going to do it, you've got to try something new out.
But it is one of those things that we all, you know, it's a universally shared experience. And because I think in part of one, the extraordinary amount of humour that you've been able to put into it, these observations, again, of the absurdities, I think that's a great word for it, of these people who are all around you, like, you know, taxi drivers, movers, you know, phoning up, trying to cancel things, you know, trying to...
Yeah,
all the things that are so frustrating and those silly things that you have to do. In cases, people out there who haven't seen it yet, I think what we must talk about maybe is the discombobulation that I think you've created within it in terms of how the collection is laid out, because that's also what keeps us on our toes. You have poems that appear sometimes horizontal, sometimes vertical, sometimes blacked out, sometimes crossed out. There's this, perhaps a sense at times of wanting the reader to feel a little bit jarred, a little bit thrown, so we're not really aware of what's coming next. Was this sort of an intentional...
Oh, definitely, both visually, you know, the form and shape of the poems on the page, one after the other, wanted to make sure I kept mixing it up, but also the emotional, the emotional kind of resonance of each poem. I didn't want the reader to be conditioned and to have, you know, six sections all of sad poems. I wanted to, you know, chop it up, keep things surprising, ensure that the reader has to keep negotiating their own emotional response to the poem. Is this, you know, and be taken by surprise because, oh my God, this one's funny or this one's sorrowful. That was really important. And when it came to the proof stage, of course, I spent a huge amount of time ensuring that the poems were neat, that they looked exactly as I wanted them. So in a couple of occasions, we've had to go down one font size or really reduce the margins back, to get every poem looking like it was if it was in a magazine, you know, originally. Yeah.
Well, I think by doing that, every time you turn the page, there's something new, there's something slightly different, there's something slightly fresh. So it never, even, you know, if the book, you know, you hold it up and it's, what, 128? Is it 128? 128 pages perhaps, but it doesn't feel 128 pages because you're constantly, as I said, a little bit thrown, you know, you're constantly like, oh, this is something new, this is something different. And even the fact that it's broken down into sections, you know, you can take it in stages.
Exactly. It reads like a novel, I think, in poems, in parts, at least the first three parts. And then, we go back in time. So it is linear, it is sequential.
In Selfie with Water Lilies, the poem that jumped out to me the most, or the poem that just, I thought this is such craft, was The Apprentice, the poem about beetroots. I think you've actually read that perhaps on the podcast a few years ago. An extraordinary poem because at the end of every single line is the word beetroot, but at no point when you're reading the poem are you hit with a beetroot. It doesn't feel clunky, forced. It doesn't feel overworked. And then in Hard Drive, you have the same, you have a poem that's almost a little bit similar in terms of its layout and relationship as a covered reservoir. And there, that wordplay there is the word water that reoccurs at the end of every single sentence. But again, you sculpt it and crafted it so perfectly that you don't even notice it. You see it on the page, but you have to keep looking at the page because you don't hear yourself repeating the word. How long does this take to produce and perfect?
I mean, it's hugely enjoyable. It's a lot of fun doing these kind of things, but you've got this one constraint, this anaphora, having this word at the end of the line. And with the beetroot poem, I mean, that's very much a poem of its time when we were all watching Apprentice with Alan Sugar. And you just start with a line, two lines, and think, can I keep this going? Can I sustain this? And there's quite a lot of enjambment in that poem. So, you know, the sentence, the word beetroot is sometimes in the middle of the sentence, it's sometimes at the end, sometimes with a question mark or exclamation, or even hyphenated and split, as in beetroot-scented perfume. So that was a huge amount of fun to write. And it's a huge amount of fun to read. Audiences always respond very well to that. The poem in the book, Relationship as Covered Reservoir, yeah, I lived in on the top of Mount View Road in Crouch End, on the top of a hill, and there was a massive covered reservoir at the end of the street, at the end of Mount View Road. And so I tried to use this reservoir as a metaphor for a long term relationship, and the strains, the stresses, the unspoken, pressures, perhaps, of being together over a long period of time. So again, I had fun with this poem, and I wanted to create a kind of heaviness, a kind of oppressive. I mean, when you look at those massive covered reservoirs, you just wonder, what on earth is it like underneath, you know, in the dark there?
Would you like to read one of them for us right now?
No, I could read that one if you like. Relationship as Covered Reservoir. All the years close to water. By a bulk of water, that hulk of water, flat water. Still water being water, water in the dark, oblivious water, obviously water. Water where water should be, water with a roof, with walls, a body of water, shared water. Everyone's water, neighbouring water, neighbourly water, water with grass on, you couldn't walk on, water close by, closed off water. Water behind railings, water off limits, supposed water, ought to be water. Take your word for it, water. Water under lock and key, padlocked water. Water with keep out signs. Official water, officious water, measured water. Metered water, believed in water, believed to be water, hypothetical water. Water waiting, patient water. Water biding its time, well-behaved water. Weekday water, rainy day water, rained on water, going nowhere water. Water, treading water. Water concealed, unrevealed, new, no surprise, water. No twilight, sunrise, water. No boats or swans, water. Nothing floating, water. No running on water. Water not sailed on. No kids laughing, water. Water you could land a helicopter on. Take off from, drown a city with, water. Water we presumed to be water. Took for granted, water. Ignored for years, water. Didn't think twice about water, blind to water, could have broken into water. Jumped up and down on water, hard water, difficult water, by itself water. A watery self, water alone, lonely water, encased water, with a lid on water, couldn't breathe water or evaporate water, let off steam water, dry water, shy water, reserved water, quiet water, some days not speaking, water, water working, water not working, getting worked up, water, water we ran and ran.
My goodness, extraordinary, such weight and tenderness combined in both. I think wordsmith is definitely a word that that needs to be applied to your talent as a writer. That's incredible. Thank you for reading that, Paul. And speaking of wordsmith, speaking of words and titles, Hard Drive, how did the title come about? I know you have the poem Hard Drive, but you think about it in so many different ways, from all the, you know, from the literally the hard drives where all our information, our pictures, our memories are stored, to what has been almost reoccurring in some of your, even in your pamphlets, those hard drives, those journeys, the journeys on the motorways, the journeys with fathers in cars where you don't know where you're going to the journey through grief. Was Hard Drive always the title?
It was possibly Anglepoise, which is the preface poem, but I felt that was a little bit too poison and poetic in the end. And Hard Drive was direct, it was immediate. Yeah, obviously, in the first instance, it refers to the hard drives that are in storage or that were in a kitchen cupboard for a long time, you know, with all the files on, all our videos, all our life. But it's indeed the hard drives to the crematorium, to collect ashes, to go to the police station, whatever. It's the hard drives, yeah, to go to the mortuary, to visit the body. Yeah, the need to keep going with something that's actually very long and arduous, the whole process of, as you know, getting the administration done, you know, clearing things. Yeah, hard drive, a relationship is a hard drive. I mean, and it can be that in a positive way as well, you know, passionate and sexy, a hard drive, you know. But I felt it opened itself up to many different explorations and interpretations.
And was the collection then itself, was there a sense of laying to rest with the collection itself?
Certainly. I mean, it's just that feeling of catharsis, of bringing it all together, of collecting it all. I mean, of course, there were many poems that didn't go into the book in the end. And you do wonder about your orphan poems. What will happen to them? Do they deserve to see the light of day? But yeah, you have to make certain creative choices. And the book was getting long. But yeah, it feels like I've laid something to rest, or at least I've created, I hope, something beautiful.
Yeah,
and made something beautiful out of pain and misery and sorrow that will live on, you know, and hopefully will give other writers permission to explore grief and loss through some of the ways I have, which was very much dealing with the day-to-day experience, dealing, you know, actually celebrating the people I met along the way who you know, as I talk about, it's a kind of soap opera of bereavement. I didn't realize I was writing about all these individuals until I saw all the poems together. And it makes sense. I mean, if you go back to those people, you know, and this interest in characters, personalities, people, that sort of makes sense. And I think when I did the launch, actually, Helena Nelson said, "Do you think you're done now, you know, with Todd?" And I don't know. I don't foresee writing any further poems, but who knows what will happen in the future.
Might be whispers. Speaking of the future, I know poetry in Aldborough suffered its own loss last year with the loss of Robin Boyd, but is there a hope for it? Is there a possibility of it returning again?
We hope so. We took a year out last year. We'd already decided before Robin passed away that we'd realised we didn't have money in the bank to run a festival. We don't receive any kind of external funding, and it's an expensive thing to put on a festival. But we were absolutely astounded in 2022 when we were back on the ground for the first time after COVID in the newly revamped ballroom arts venue. But yes, unfortunately, last year we couldn't put one on anyway. Robin suddenly passed away, so we've taken a breather. But there is new blood. There are new poets who have moved up to Suffolk. We are now having team meetings, and we're hopefully going to be putting on a festival this November, 8th to 10th. It's always a kind of party weekend by the sea. So we've reserved our venue, and hopefully there will be poetry back on the ground in Aldborough by the sea, close to the beach.
And hopefully then later on this year, we'll also hear more from you, perhaps reading around the country, reading England or Ireland, perhaps from hard drive. That would be lovely.
That would be amazing. I need to organise myself. I did a few readings in the summer and autumn in London and Belfast. I really should set up some readings for this spring and summer.
Excellent. Any festivals out there listening in, just give Paul a little DM. Well, listen, Paul, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to have this conversation with you. I wish you so much luck in the future and look forward to seeing you, hopefully in person someday soon.
Thanks. Thanks so much for allowing me to talk on and around the book and the poems. It's been a real pleasure.
And now, just before we go, there's time for me to leave you with one poem, and I've decided to leave you with this poem in particular because it's from my debut collection, Enough, which Paul Stevenson very kindly wrote a blurb for, and also because his publisher for Hard Drive is Carcanet Press, and last week I was at the launch of Eggshell, Victoria Kennefic's second extraordinary collection, and I thought this poem in particular felt like a really good fit for today. This is called Some People That We Used To Be. We sit now and sip cocktails. The waiter pulls out your chair and hands me the menu after calling you, madame. I strain now to hear your voice. Softer, gentler, feminine, finding freedom. I catch you checking your lipstick in the mirror, pulling a curl back into place above those blushed cheekbones, still a little swollen. A normal evening in August in Paris, sipping gins and rums and telling tales, swapping stories in Korean restaurants that give us a brief taste of who it was that we used to be. We sit over cocktails, the man and the madame, looking like a couple in the reflection of the tainted mirror. And I wonder if anyone can tell, as you smooth out your skirt, that you used to be my boyfriend.
And gentle persons, in betweeners and nonconformers, genders all and genders equal, we've now reached the end of another episode of Eat the Storms, the poetry podcast. Thank you all so much for joining me here today. I've been Damien B. Donnelly, your host and producer, and I imagine you've tuned in on a platform like Spotify, Apple, Google, Breaker, Podbean, Player FM, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Castbox, Podcast Addicts, or iTunes. As always, for details on all of my guests, you can head on over to our website, www.eatthestorms.com. And if you click on that listen to the podcast section, you will find a blog post for every episode. This was episode 5, season 8. And in that blog post, you will find bios, social media handles, website links and photographs so you can find, follow and be fans of all my fantastic guests today. While you're over there, perhaps you might also want to pick up a copy of The Storms, or one of our printed journals of poetry, prose and visual arts. So far, we've had 3 exceptional issues, giving home to over 250 international artists. And later this year, we will be opening again for issue 4. Now, I say this at the end of every episode of Eat the Storms, but it's very important. Please don't be shy if you've enjoyed the podcast, and feel free to shout about it. If you've enjoyed it, if you think you know people who might enjoy it even more than you do, then please let them know. Shout about it, post about it. This is an international podcast, an international community, and here at Eat the Storms, we realise that the spotlight can only truly give off enough warmth when it is shared with others. So please do us a favour and share, scream and shout. Now, thank you once again to Paul Stevenson, Catherine Meehan, Luis Costa and Brian Kirk. Until next week, when we gather to welcome another four extraordinary visionaries to the podcast, please keep writing, keep shining, keep supporting, and most of all, make sure that you all stay bloody poetic.
Oh, thank you.